Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Hello, everybody out there. JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann, is back in your earbuds or your speakers, or maybe it's over the airport tannoy. Well, probably not the last. Anyhow, it's good to be back in touch. We've missed you. We hope that you missed us. As always, please visit https://www.espgen.org/knowledge-center to examine the offerings. And don't forget ESPGEN's annual meeting, 14th through 17th of May in Helsinki. Today, Jake is serving us up something that's rather tough to chew and something that seems to make good sense on the face of it. The easier one first, which is from JPGN by Richie et al., writing from Aberdeen up in Scotland, and Christchurch, the one in New Zealand. It's titled, The Role of Non-Contrast Enhanced Abdominal Ultrasound in the Diagnostic Assessment of Pediatric Inflammatory Bowel Disease. This is, if I can sum it up, it's a retrospective review of how endoscopy, biopsy examination, magnetic resonance enterography, and non-contrast sonography contributed to classification of inflammatory bowel disease in 47 Kiwi children, Kiwi being a slang term for persons from New Zealand. Particular attention to small bowel involvement was paid. Of those 47, 14 had no evidence of small bowel disease. That leaves 33 with evidence of small bowel disease, of whom 19 had non-contrast sonography evidence. In 7 of these, endoscopy, biopsy, and magnetic resonance enterography had not found evidence of small bowel disease. In 12, non-contrast sonography confirmed small bowel disease identified by other means and contributed to diagnosis by finding involvement at sites not otherwise identified. In other words, more extensive disease. And in 14 of the 33, NCS drew a blank, finding no evidence of small bowel disease, although either endoscopy or biopsy or magnetic resonance enterography had indicated small bowel disease. Non-contrast sonography thus appeared insufficient to identify approximately 2/5 of IBD patients as having small bowel involvement. However, NCS expanded diagnosis in approximately 1/5 of IBD patients to include small bowel involvement. For me, that means that NCS on its own is not enough. But it also means that NCS is something that should be used in order to make sure that you're covering all the bases. Jake, that was a long-winded rant. Did I get things mostly right?
Mostly right as always, Alex. I think this is...
I hate that mostly. Okay.
Well, we're all mostly right most of the time. I think that this paper is timely as there's a growing push really towards the use of non-contrast enhanced ultrasound, whether that's in the radiology department or at the bedside, for diagnosis of intestinal disorders. Here they're focusing on one of the main problems that we see, inflammatory bowel disease. Our group's also discussed about rejection in small bowel transplant, and a point of care ultrasound is now almost routine practice, certainly in the emergency department. But here this paper is discussing scans that were done in the radiology department by radiographers or radiologists. And part of the lead up to this was that in many of the patients that they saw, particularly the younger patients and some of those who with neurodevelopmental disorders, they were either unable to access MRE or they were unable to tolerate an MRE. And obviously they still needed overlap of data in some patients who had both, but that was the main rationale that they've explained why 50% of the patients had ultrasounds requested.
Trouble putting those kids through a magnetic resonance scanner, what with the noise and the confinement and the, I'm too young to understand what's going on.
Yes, and there is the challenge that you can't necessarily just do it under GA because it needs to have a significant intake of oral contrast. So unless then it's given down an NG tube, but then that all then becomes quite a risky procedure.
Oh, yeah. It's a GA, general anesthesia, just to make clear. Okay.
Sorry, yes, under general anesthesia. Now, these patients obviously are already having a general anesthetic. I assume that's how they do it in New Zealand for their endoscopy. But then, well, I suppose you could do a non-contrast MR. But anyway, I think that it certainly highlights a potential patient group who may not be able to access MRE for a variety of reasons and ask the question, could a standard ultrasound done in the department help you with diagnosing small bowel Crohn's? Really, that's the focus here. And I suppose my main takeaway is that I'm not convinced based on this data.
Oh, why not?
I'm a little bit skeptical of this study being used as evidence to show the sensitivity and specificity of a relatively unvalidated tool with no reference standard. So, for example, what I mean is they're paying particular attention to the group who had evidence of small bowel abnormalities on their ultrasound, but who had normal MRE and, I presume, ileal biopsies and duodenal biopsies.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would be a little bit skeptical of, or I'd be initially cautious, perhaps, of escalating someone's treatment or putting them onto biologics, for example, if they had no abnormalities on endoscopy and the histopathologist had not found any small bowel abnormalities. It doesn't feel like a very high quality level of evidence. What I suppose I would have found stronger would be if you had, say, found that patients had histological abnormalities that correlated with ultrasound despite a normal MRE.
Mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm,
I would have said is a better level of evidence. Of course, these patients, I presume, have not had push-through enterographies where they've mapped the whole small bowel and taken biopsies throughout. But I just feel a little bit uncomfortable about small numbers of individuals and no reference standard for that group that they're paying particular attention to.
So there's a watershed in treatment, I'm ignorant of this fact, between persons who have small bowel involvement and persons who do not. And
well,
if you have small bowel, go on.
It's one of the factors that you would consider as to whether you needed to escalate someone's treatment. Mm-hmm. And small bowel Crohn's is difficult to diagnose. And in the correct clinical context, this, of course, may be a cofactor.
Jake, help this non-clinician understand what the downside is to bringing out a slightly larger caliber gun. What happens when you say move to biologics was the phrase you used. What's the downside?
I mean, the biologics now are essentially a routine part of care. However, we do have to acknowledge that they come with risks of increased risk of sepsis, reactivation of tuberculosis. There's a risk of lymphoma. There is the patient burden of needing an infusion every 4 to 8 weeks, typically. And the cost, depending on the exact healthcare model and locale. So, whilst
we're still we're still in primum non nocere, we said first do no harm. And leave treatments out that aren't rigorously identified as needful.
But saying that, my understanding of the data is that patients who have early introduction of biologics in general do better at a cohort level.
So rather than stepping up to biologics.
Rather than stepping up to biologics or having a lower threshold to step up to biologics. Hmm. So I guess I'm not saying that that is necessarily a bad thing to do, to treat, escalate treatment as soon as it may be needed. I guess I'm not totally convinced by this paper as providing evidence that ultrasound is an optimum method for diagnosing small bowel Crohn's.
Right. Well, our producer has just given me the high sign that we don't have enough time to talk about this anymore. So let's move on to the very hard going article that you pulled out of Nature for us. That article is called Deep Visual Proteomics: Mapping Proteotoxicity in a Genetic Liver Disease. Really a proof of principle article written by Florian Rosenberger et al. With co-authors at various institutions in Czechia, Denmark, and Germany. The genetic disorder that was chosen for using deep visual proteomics, and I didn't know what they were either before reading this article, and I'm not sure that I yet do, was alpha-1 antitrypsin storage disorder. Call it A1A for alpha-1 antitrypsin and A1ASD for the storage disorder. In A1ASD, substitution mutations in the gene SERPINA1 lead to retention and accumulation of A1A within hepatocytes. Of course, this is manifest serologically as deficiency of A1A in circulation, but if your particular mutation abolishes A1A synthesis and there's no accumulation, then you don't have A1ASD. And you don't have liver disease. You may have lung disease, you may have vascular disease, but the liver is spared. At any rate, how accumulation of A1A within hepatocytes injures them, that is, the mechanism of proteotoxicity in A1ASD, is unclear. The Nature article took a double handful of hepatectomy and hepatic resection specimens from adults with A1ASD and undertook histologic staining, microdissection, and mass spectrometry of individual hepatocytes that were affected with quantitated identification of individual proteins at sites of injury. The gist that I derive from this is that upregulation of the unfolded protein response, that is, getting rid of garbage proteins, is paired with downregulation of synthesis and secretion by hepatocytes. So the liver doesn't work so well as it ought to do. Then engaging the extent of variation in the spectrum of proteins being synthesized and where they were located was prominent in samples from persons with, I beg your pardon, that is, peroxisomal activation in terms of more of that, the proteins involved, was prominent in samples from persons with less A1ASD-associated fibrosis and fell off in samples from persons with more such fibrosis, that is, more injury or later stage injury. So the authors offer the speculation that peroxisome activators may be useful in modulating later stage disease. The tissue samples, though, all came from adults, fifth decade into eighth decade. And we still don't have a clue, it seems to me, from this study, as to how A1ASD leads to cholestasis in some infants, but not in others. You always have something to improve my grasp of these papers, and I'm looking forward to what it is this time.
I think you've grasped it very well, Alex. I think the main thing for me is just I guess it's mind-blowing that they can do proteomics at a single cell level. I mean, this is work from Matthias Mann's group, who have led the field, really, in proteomics. And I just can't totally understand the amount of effort that will have gone into optimizing this technique, where they do an initial stain on these tissues and then use a laser to cut out individual hepatocytes, and then can do proteomics on them and use that to identify about 2,500 proteins per hepatocyte.
They use mass spectrometry to identify the proteins, which, geez Louise, think of the degree of precision that there must be, not only to identify them, but also to quantitate them.
The skill involved throughout is enormous. And obviously this paper makes it look very simple, but this will be decades of work going into leading up to this. And I suppose I find this particularly interesting because we all recognize that alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is a highly heterogeneous disorder, both between patients and even within the individual liver. There are various regions where you have worse accumulation of alpha-1 antitrypsin and variable impact on or evidence of inflammation and fibrosis. And this actually combined with another paper that was published in Nature Genetics in the last month, I feel goes some way to explain that. So if you'll allow me the liberty to introduce a third paper just as a side note.
I protest, your lordships. This was this evidence was not put before the court.
It's relevant. I promise it's relevant. So,
all right.
So there was another paper recently done by Matthew Hoare's group, a paper in Nature Genetics by Brzozowska et al., published in March this year, which basically looked at somatic mutations in alpha-1 antitrypsin. So obviously all these patients have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, but then in addition to that, they acquired mutations not in their germline, in the hepatocytes. And they broadly showed that areas that had less accumulation of alpha-1 antitrypsin, those hepatocytes had acquired mutations which caused truncation of alpha-1 antitrypsin so that they didn't accumulate as much of the aggregates. And then we have
this
paper.
Wait a minute. But these all were patients that had the standard ZZ phenotype, yes?
Correct.
Which means that SERPINA1 acquired second mutations that eliminated synthesis.
Or at least reduced,
markedly curtailed synthesis.
Yes, or reduced aggregation at a post-translational level.
All right.
And then we have this paper that is basically showing how that impacts hepatocytes, which really clearly illustrates that the degree of damage to an individual hepatocyte is determined within that hepatocyte. There isn't transfer of alpha-1 antitrypsin between. It's really whether each individual hepatocyte accumulates more or less aggregates, which influences their amount of dysfunction in their other organelles, principally their endoplasmic reticulum and their peroxisomes. And then when they accumulate more, they die and put out apoptotic inflammatory ligands, which is what we've kind of always known about the general process. But now it's been shown that this happens at a individual cell level, and one hepatocyte may do it when the one next to it may have almost no effect on alpha-1 antitrypsin.
God sends these hepatocytes out into the world and says, kids, you're on your own.
Something like that.
Well, the other metaphor that I'm thinking is that Harvard University has always said that its individual schools have to finance themselves for themselves. Each ship sailing on its own bottom is the phrase that's used, and that there's going to be no transfer of money back and forth from, say, the humanities, not that the humanities will attract a lot of funding, or the other way around, from STEM institutions to the humanities. Rigorous, harsh, but I imagine fair. And here we are now. When are we going to be able to get at the mechanisms of neonatal cholestasis? I've often wondered if doing a genomic search for heterozygosity for, say, a bit of this and that, haploinsufficiency perhaps, in other cholestasis-associated genes might be more frequent in those A1AT storage disorder kids who turn up yellow early in life. What do you think?
I think that it's a really interesting question, and it's going to be one that is hard to address because in the majority of children who have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency and significant cholestasis or not significant cholestasis, we don't get a bit of their liver because it's one of the things that we can diagnose or at least have a very good idea about by blood tests or genetics. So,
I'm shaking my head. Heresy is being propagated here.
It happens sometimes that we don't do a biopsy, and therefore...
Sucking my teeth in dismay.
I think it's unclear whether the degree of... whether those children who have cholestasis have more accumulation of alpha-1 antitrypsin versus those that have the same mutation or the same degree of lack of alpha-1 antitrypsin in the serum, but then aren't affected with cholestasis. I think it's a really interesting study, and obviously this paper doesn't go any way to address that.
Right. Well, I'm downcast. I'm taken aback. The idea of a child with... Hey, okay. But in order to address that question, you might not necessarily need a liver biopsy specimen. You can do genetics on peripheral blood leukocytes and find out if those kids are harboring a second hit somewhere. Can you not?
Yes. I think that the crux of it, though, you would want to... you'd need to clinch it by correlating with what you see in the liver.
Once again, we're going to have to agree to disagree. I think that once you've established that there's a problem with handling alpha-1 antitrypsin, then the effects will be outside the endoplasmic reticulum, downstream from whatever the insult is, and some kids will be less equipped to handle that insult because of that second hit than will others. So that if you say are haploinsufficient for ABCB11, biosalt export pump, then you're going to get into more trouble if you also have a ZZ phenotype.
Agreed.
Wow. We've achieved unity. Now all we have to do is find a cure for the common cold, and it's a successful day. Jake, talk to me. Cat got your tongue?
I'm just looking forward to seeing you in person in a few weeks' time at the ESPGHAN annual meeting, Alex. See you there.
Thank you, matey. All right. Everybody out there, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you the next time.